I need, I'm a kinesthetic kind of guy. I need to see someone doing it and be involved in that. And so just that mentorship of being shown things, you know, by hand, for me was just like, you know, I lapped it up. It was just, it was like honey, liquid gold. It was amazing. And then it wasn't really till afterwards I realized how much I had learned about what was Robin's way of keeping bees, if you like. And he certainly was very much of an ilk that he would lose a few colonies every year, but he would get a few colonies every year. So there was this natural balance.
Hello, and welcome to the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I'm Carl from selfsufficienthub.com, and I'm here to talk about all things self-sufficiency. Sustainability and food security matters. Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 101 of the Self-Sufficient Hub podcast. I hope you're all safe and well. Today is part two of our interview with Alan and Mike from the Homesteading UK podcast, or rather Urban Homesteading UK podcast. And I just wanted to reiterate to you guys that their podcast is one that I absolutely genuinely listen to and enjoy. So I just wanted to urge you all to go and check them out and go and check them out on Facebook as well. So that's the Urban Homesteading UK podcast. Alan and Mike are just kindred spirits, really. I feel privileged to have connected with them, and I genuinely mean it when I say that I hope that this conversation was just the first of many. But now I will hand you over to the second part of that conversation with Alan and Mike from the Urban Homesteading UK podcast. When I'm looking at my plot, it's really clear to me that I've been absolutely gifted this opportunity, you know. And a big part of why I started the podcast originally, and I've said this to you previously, Alan, when we spoke on the phone, that I didn't really feel like there was anyone talking about what I was doing. There were lots of people with homesteading podcasts and YouTube channels and things like that, but on the whole they were people in America. And while that there was a lot there I could relate to, there's also a lot that doesn't transition to the sort of the way we do it here. And you know, I didn't have any big machinery. I wasn't looking at doing lots and lots of more traditional farming, if you like. It was all very much based around the kitchen. And I think that is something that definitely does translate across to you guys and to lots of the other people in the UK that I speak to and abroad who are doing it on a more regular house type basis rather than a plot of farmland, basically.
That's
definitely something that I felt, Carl, which is why I sort of set it all up in our podcast up in the first place, was that exactly that. You know, it doesn't always translate very well. And for me, it was very much about, you know, very small plot. How can you do what you know, what can you do on it? And that the British perspective and sort of nobody talking about what I was doing either. Obviously, you just started up and sort of doing your bit as well. And there wasn't much other, there wasn't anything other than that as far as I'm aware. And so it's very much coming from the same place as you are, trying to sort of get the message out that this is how we do it in the UK, and, you know, getting people talking about what we're doing, because there's lots of people like us. I know that, you know, we know that for a fact, don't we? Otherwise, there wouldn't be people listening now.
I think also there's a cyclical process, isn't there? And I know, you know, I can tell you how excited I was when I read John Seymour's book about self-sufficiency. I can remember it. And I'm a real advocate of that book. But, you know, when I read that and that light came on, this is what I've been thinking all these times. And there's, you know, there's this guy who writes in this beautiful matter-of-fact way, and he talks about doing it on 5 acres or 1 acre. But when he starts talking about husbandry and all of that, and I'm just like, I totally get that. But I just remember the first time reading that book, it really sort of, it resonated with me, because I suppose also running through perhaps all three of us is this bit of this sort of questioning when you see something or you've had to buy something, then the next question is, how do they do that? How do they make that? Where does it come from? And then there's that little bit. And Alan, I've got to say, you got it worse than me, mate. It's the bit where he says, I could do that better. I can definitely do that, make that better. And it can be better for you. And it can be cheaper. Yeah. So there's definitely an element of that as well, isn't there? That we reckon we can do it better. And I have to say, most of the time we can. So that's pretty good. Well, you're definitely well ahead of me in that scape, mate. But certainly also there's this. I'm aware of this cyclical process. You know, growing up when we did, and we hark back to the 70s and the good life and that show, and then you know coming in now with what is so poignant with the single use plastics and wondering where our stuff comes from and all of that. You know, we're riding that wave a little bit, but I think that it has run all the way through, you know, but it just sort of, you know, the popularity and the kind of, and the kind of awareness of it seems to surface every now and then in a kind of cyclical way as well. Certainly over the last few years, but just going back through John Seymour and then finding out what his, you know, what his experiences and the things that had inspired him were, you know, makes me feel like I'm part of a much deeper, longer tradition going back of people who've been not only had to do it, but people who've chose to do it. And, you know, and Alan and I have spoke about that before, is that, you know, we're a generation who, if we want to, we can buy tomatoes, you know, we can get all these things, but perhaps we've got some choices about not just the having to get it, but, you know, having to be a bit more aware of where it's come from and could we do it better and kind of what is the cost and the food miles and all of that. I'm not sure that some of some of our family before us have had that. So there's definitely that link back to the past again. And then what am I handing on to my kids? You know, what practices can I bump onto them? That's certainly in the mix for me.
It's really easy for you to get in touch with us. You can do it either by sending an email to selfsufficientcontact@gmail.com or by using the link in the show notes to send us a voice message. You can send us a voice message just using your phone. You could also reach out to us on Facebook, where we have the Self-Sufficient Hub group and the Self-Sufficient Hub page. We're always thrilled to get your feedback, questions, or suggestions for future topics on the show.
I was just going to say, I just think there's definitely a thing about becoming a father that makes a big difference as well. I mean, Mike's saying about trying to do things better than the supermarkets. One of the big drivers for me was that my kids were born. When my kids were born, I didn't want to be feeding them bread that had been so highly processed and was so full of salt. So I made bread with less salt in it. It's that straightforward. It wasn't complicated. It was just the kids needed to not be eating too much salt. So we'll make bread that they can eat that hasn't got too much salt in it. It takes the drama out of the situation. It wasn't complicated. It wasn't difficult. And it kind of drives it. And then it becomes, well, what's the next thing that we can do that's going to improve?
Yeah.
It goes, rolls from there, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It also puts you, well, to lead on from that, Alan, it also puts you in just more control of your impact as well, but both upstream and downstream.
Yeah.
So, you're having far more choice and you're having far more control over both what you're eating, what your children are eating, in the case you mentioned, but also you're having choice over your impact on the lives of the people or animals that are providing you with the things that you're choosing to buy. Because I know for me personally, the idea of, in fact, I'll phrase it in another way. Someone asked me, I think it was in reply to one of my YouTube videos, that they asked me, and they weren't being facetious at all. It was an honest question, but they said, how do you feel when you have to kill one of your animals, one of your chickens or whatever? Mm-hmm. And, or how does it feel? How does it make you feel? And I, my honest answer was, it just feels honest. Mm-hmm. It feels far more honest than taking a piece of animal muscle out of a plastic container from the fridge that arrived in a delivery van from the supermarket, when I've got absolutely no idea of the provenance of that meat, how that animal was raised, what it was fed, how it was cared for, what sort of life it had. It just feels far more honest to know that when you're eating a piece of meat, in the case of the deer that you mentioned in the recent episode, Mike, that it had lived a natural,
you know, as happy as a wild animal can be life. And in the case of my pigs, for example, you know, they've had the perfect life. They've lived in pig heaven for the time that they've been alive, and then they've been slaughtered absolutely humanely. And, you know, I just feel so much happier about that than I do going to the supermarket.
I think both Alan and I would like, that would be probably the area that, given an expansion, we would push into would be about the protein question for us. You know, whether that's through sea fishing, which I'm into, you know, beach fishing, or being able to be more proficient at providing meat. For me, that, because of the space, for me, that is through hunting and being able to process wild meat that I can forage. But I can't explain that moment when you literally take a life, how grounding that is, like what you're saying. But it is, you know, it is kind of primordial. I know that, and I know that for some people that, you know, they choose not to live that way, and they might want to, you know, have a vegetarian or vegan based diet. Of course, that's, everyone's got their own freedom and choice in that. But I know for me, that real deep connection that I've got through that runs through the earth and through all of those different things that I do, without getting too spiritual, is certainly connected to, you know, those moments when I'm in control of how I've done that. And I certainly give that the most, you know, when I, you know, if I'm lucky enough to get a rabbit or something like that, I certainly give that the most diligence and the most care when I'm cooking it, because I want to do it justice. Yeah. You know, I'm aware of what I've done and what I've taken, and I want to do it justice. You know, it's an honor. Well,
there's a great saying: every animal deserves a good life, a good death, a good butcher, and a good chef. And
yeah, well, I can do the first four. Normally,
three out of four ain't bad. But I've said several times, you know, when it comes to the issue of meat and veganism and stuff, I've got the utmost respect for vegans, vegetarians. I'm not trying to change anyone's opinion or point of view, and all I'm ever doing is just explaining why I do what I do. Now, I think if you are a vegan for moral and ethical reasons, I think that's a very solid place to stand morally and ethically. I just think where I stand is also a very solid place to stand morally and ethically, you know.
No, I completely agree. And a friend of mine is a vegan. He lives far away now, but we had a conversation a while back about, you know, perhaps I'd like to be a vegan. And I just said to him, honestly, mate, you know me better than that. I'm sort of one of the most keen meat eaters, you know. But what I might do is reduce the amount of meat that I eat. I might eat better quality meat, and I might eventually like to try and produce my own meat, because exactly as you say, in terms of a moral standpoint, that's about as good as it can get. You give the animals the best life you can. You know where they've come from, and exactly all that. I think, you know, making sure you care for those animals is far better than sort of plastic act. But at the same time, Mike and I both have to be realistic that the space that we've got to grow and the space that we've got to produce means that, you know, I do still have to go to the supermarket or the farm shop every week, because realistically, I've still got to feed my family. What I produce isn't enough to feed all of us. Certainly not all year round. There are times when, you know, most of the vegetables might have come from the garden in the summertime particularly, but not all of them still. And so it's kind of like, where do we get those? And the reality of our situation is very much that we kind of have to make those compromises at times. So it's about then where do you choose to spend that? Where do you choose to use that consumer power to try and make sure that those the best choices are made on your behalf, if you like, by the farmer, by the producers.
Sure.
It's just the nature of the, you know, the space that we've got.
So when you take a bit of a swerve now, when you first reached out to me, Alan, it was as well as just a general communication, because we've obviously got a lot in common, and there was a useful reason to have a good line of communication open to start talking about things like this. But one of the main things that you mentioned was beekeeping, because as you know, I am a very, very new beekeeper, but you guys between you have got much more experience. So I wonder if you would like to just share a bit of your thoughts on beekeeping with us.
Well, I suppose, I mean, probably what I should say first of all is that I'm a beekeeper because Mike was a beekeeper before me. And it's a classic example of us egging each other on, and him coming saying to me one day, "Oh, I'm going to see the bees. You fancy coming out and having a look in the hive?" And it was very much a case of, you know, one finger in the the comb and the honey still warm from the hive, and then in my mouth, and that was it. I was completely hooked. It was there was no question about one about whether I was going to be a beekeeper. It was just when I was going to be a beekeeper. Just another string to add to your bow, and then it's about where do you keep the bees. But the reason I reached out, obviously, was that, you know, you talk a lot in your podcast about permaculture and, you know, I suppose kind of organic, if you like, in inverted commas, practices in the garden. And I'm very aware that typically when you go to see meet conventional beekeepers, it's very much about what treatments do you use to deal with pests and parasites in the hive. And I was very concerned that, you know, if you've been going to the Beekeeping Association's kind of training, which is a perfectly legitimate place to start and actually a very good place to start, you might have been fed kind of this line that you must treat your bees for Varroa mite in particular, which has been, you know, it's been the biggest problem for bees for the last 25, 30 years, I suppose. And at one point, it looked like bee populations were going to take a real hit, and they did for a while. But there's lots of people out there that still believe you need to treat for Varroa mite. And the reality, certainly in my experience, and Mike's experience, is that isn't the case. You know, that if you take sort of Darwinian ideas about evolution, that if you treat for mites, all you actually do is have stronger mites and weaker bees. We look at it the other way. We tend not to interfere in our hives too often, mainly because we're a bit too busy and lazy most of the time, truthfully. we don't treat the bees for anything. We kind of, as best as we can, we leave them to do it for themselves and figure it out for themselves. Because ultimately, certainly my view anyway, and I wouldn't speak for Mike on this, but my view is that they're wild animals that happen to live in a box, which I may have happened to put in a particular location. But they're still wild animals. They're not my pets. They're not livestock. They are just a wild colony of bees that have moved in. And so I try and treat them as such. And similarly to the way I do my vegetable patch, I don't use chemicals on the vegetable patch because I'm going to feed those to my children, those vegetables. I don't use chemicals in my beehives because I'm going to feed that honey to my children as well. For me, that's not what you should be doing where you can avoid it. And that was my original reason for reaching out, really, was just to make you aware that there were other ways to do it. And it's something that I happen to be lucky enough to stumble across when I started out. But I suppose you should talk about it, Mike, because you were the one that taught me to beekeep in the first place.
You can find Self-Sufficient Hub content elsewhere online in lots of other places. We have a YouTube channel. We also have our website. And now there's our Facebook page and Facebook group. Links to all of these you can find in the show notes. Come check us out.
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky, wasn't I? Because when I moved to this house, I literally was standing at the end of my drive one day, and this old chap walked past me with this hand cart with a load of supers on it, and I was just like, "What? I want to learn that. I want to do that." And it was very much, you know, building on what we've said before, he said, well, you know, if you want to help me out, he was an older guy, you can shadow me and I'll teach you how I keep bees. And he kept them literally just up the road within, you know, 2 minutes walk. And he would call me up and say, I'm going out and I'm going over to this other out apiary and we're going to go and look round. And I learned so much from him. His name was Robin, you know, God rest his soul. And I, you know, without that hands-on experience, I actually don't think I would have ever got into it. I don't think I probably would have joined an association or anything like that. I'm a kinesthetic kind of guy. I need to see someone doing it and be involved in that. And so just that mentorship of being shown things, you know, by hand, for me was just like, you know, I lapped it up. It was just, it was like light honey, liquid gold. It was amazing. And then it wasn't really till afterwards I realised how much I had learned about what was Robin's way of keeping bees, if you like. And he certainly was very much of an ilk that he would lose a few colonies every year, but he would get a few colonies every year. So there was this natural balance of swarm control. He would do a bit, but if he lost a swarm out of a colony, it wasn't the end of the world. And I think that a lot of that stemmed from the fact that he was keeping bees for himself and his family. So he probably had about 10 hives overall, and maybe three or four were at good production. Three and four were sort of building, and maybe a couple were on the way out, if you like. So there was always this more natural way rather than this high intensity, you know, real kind of intrusive way of keeping. And that really fitted in with, one, my kind of lifestyle, but also my outlook upon things. You know, I don't want to keep things under high stress and feed in constantly. And what was interesting to me was that when I first met Robin, he did treat his bees, and he used to treat them like most people do, with a variety of different products. But as I knew him over the sort of 10 or 15 years, he moved away from that, and he kept he was really knowledgeable chap, and he used to read a lot of journals, and you know, he was a very learned man himself. But he came up with his own ideas about things, and he used to make his own time-based treatments, you know, using essential oils and natural material, things like that.
Yeah.
But I think that by the end of it, he had come over to the fact that he didn't need, it didn't really make a lot of difference if he did or he didn't. He was an association man, but he viewed them with a sort of, you know, a great deal of suspicion, you know, which was quite nice in that he always sort of, you know, sometimes I'd tag along with him to association meetings, and he would sort of say, you know, don't take this too seriously, young fellow. You know, there was an element of that,
yeah.
which certainly I've passed along in people who've spoke to me about bees, but I'm very aware that it's not, you know, always viewed, well, you know, some people think that the way we keep bees might add to varroa numbers. You know, there's lots of different ways of keeping bees, but you know, when you come back to it, it's just a wooden box. That's what it is, a wooden box that bees decide to fill with honeycomb. And if it's not a wooden box, it can be a straw skep or something like that. So there is this sort of overcomplication sometimes that occurs when you overthink things, isn't there?
You can now support the show directly. Just go to patreon.com/selfsufficientherb. You can become a patron and set up to donate to the show from any amount. Pledging as little as $3 a month makes a huge difference. If that's not your thing, you can also support the show by sharing it with people you know or posting about it on social media. We really appreciate all the help that you give us. It's people like you that make this show possible.
It really did connect with me, what Alan said when you originally reached out, because you know, I was already thinking that way, but I'm also very acutely aware that I don't know enough to have an opinion yet, if that makes sense. You know, I'm very, very much at the beginning stage, so I certainly feel that there's a lot in the ethos that you're talking about that is for me, and I'm very much keen to be as unobtrusive and uninterfering as possible with the bees. I really don't want to, beyond the first year or so when I'm going to be inspecting them a little bit more, but that's so that I get used to it and so I know what I'm looking for and become familiar with it. But I really don't want to be going in the hive all that often at all. And I am not trying to get as much honey as possible. They're not a, you know, I'm not trying to farm them for honey as best I can. I'm keeping them because honey is going to be a nice byproduct, but I want to be as unobtrusive as possible. So there's certainly a lot I'm going to be reaching out to you guys in the future for, to be picking your brains on that, I think.
That'd be a pleasure. I think the key, certainly for the medium to long term, is to keep more bees than you need. I think the point that Mike made about Robin keeping his 10 hives and 3 rooms for production, well, that would keep you with more than enough honey for your family for the year. But he's got 10 hives managing. It mightn't be the same 3 hives every year producing that honey, but some, you know, one of the hives somewhere, 3 of the hives somewhere, will be producing sufficient honey for you to, you know, to look after your family for the year, and perhaps a bit to surplus to sell to your friends and family and neighbours and whatever. And that for me was the thing. And I think, you know, if people wanted to sort of delve into that more deeply, and yourself, Carl, if you wanted to delve into that more deeply, I would. It's not going anymore as a podcast, but I'm a big podcast fan and I listen to lots of different ones. And I was lucky to find the treatment-free beekeeping podcast by a guy called Solomon Parker in America. And again, similarly, things don't translate that well across the pond sometimes, in the way that they keep bees and the size of the boxes that they use and things like that. So it feels like when you listen to it, the bees go much quicker over there than they do over here, and they produce much more quickly and perhaps for longer at different times of the year, depending on where in America that they are. But certainly a lot of the principles around, you know, not treating and not interfering and trying to let the bees be bees and let the bees decide, because actually they know far better than I do after their how many millions of years of evolution to get to the point that they're at. A lot in that to learn if you're interested in going down that route.
I'll pick up on one thing there, which I think maybe could permeate through a lot of what we said. It interested me there when you said you were a bit inexperienced to have an opinion. I think you have got an opinion. I think you really have, and I think you should hold on to that, Carl, because, you know, we all start from somewhere, and even though it might not be about bees, you've got an idea about how you want to keep bees, and I can tell that just from the way in which you've been talking, you know, evening. And so I think your opinion is as valid as anyone else's. I think the experience of, you know, what to do when you see things and being able to read combs and hives and all of that, that's something else. But I think your opinion is just as valid as anyone else's. And I think that's probably why, you know, when Alan was talking to you right at the beginning, he reached out, is because everyone's opinion is as valid, you know. And that's really important to hold on to that. Really important.
And there'll be a way to do it. If you've got that opinion, that idea about wanting to be treatment free and try and do it that way, there are other people out there doing it. So there are ways to find to do it. So whatever way you want to do it, the chances are somebody's already doing it somewhere. That's my experience. Certainly you think, oh, this really clever idea, I'm going to do this. And you Google it, and all of a sudden there's like 25 different people with pictures and videos and everything. Someone's already done it somewhere. That's normally how it works.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that this is going to be just the first of many conversations that we have, you know, across all different mediums, be it for my podcast, be it for your podcast, or be it just on the phone. And I'd like to just plant a flag in this idea that maybe we do come back and we do a, whether it's called treatment-free beekeeping or just beekeeping, but a beekeeping conversation for my show. I think that'd be really valuable if you guys would be willing for, you know, and up for doing that.
I'd be well up for that.
And we'd very much like to be back on our show at some point, Carl, as well. I think it'd be really, really interesting to get you to come and join in with one of our conversations, because we're very sort of loose with what we do, listen to it, and just having a chat and a catch up, and actually an opportunity to catch up with you and what you've been up to would be really interesting to make some comparisons as well.
Yeah, well, I would absolutely love to do that as well. And I feel like this is kind of like a good natural time to maybe start wrapping things up. Is there anything in particular that you, either of you, wanted to say that you haven't had the chance?
I'd just like to say thanks for having us. We've had it's been lovely to meet yourself and hear your perspectives. And obviously, I'm sure that we'll be, you know, learning lots from you as we go forward. And just to reiterate to people to get out there and try something, you know, whatever it is, just be connected to something, really, I suppose. But I'm sure Alan will give you all of our details.
And to be honest, Carl, from my perspective, I'd like to thank you for what you're doing, because obviously you've been very prolific. We're up to about episode 6, and you're on nearly 100, aren't you? I've not been able to keep up with you, but I'm trying to sort of keep up as best as I can with your output, and trying to listen as much as I can, and really appreciate the fact that you're doing what you do, because there's obviously a lot of time and effort going into it, and I know that you've already got a very busy lifestyle, and you must have a very busy lifestyle with a full-time job and those acres to look after. And I think that the service that you're doing to the British community of sort of self-sufficient pods, homesteaders and whatever, is really valuable, and I really appreciate it. And I've enjoyed listening to your show, and I've learned lots from listening to your show. So I do very much appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, both of you. So then, Alan, I guess, where can people find you?
We're the Urban Homesteading UK podcast. We've got an Urban Homesteading UK podcast Facebook group. We're also on Instagram, my name, Urban Homesteading UK. At the moment, that's as far as we go. Obviously, we're looking to try and build a bit of a community and people to come and listen if they've got any value out of, find any value in what we're saying and doing. But come and find us on there and do come and give us a shout out and whatever, and let us know you're following and listening, because it's really, you know, important to reach out and meet with the community and interact with people. It's a lot of the point of doing it is about trying to build that knowledge. And the reason we've come on here today with you, Carl, is to help you in your quest to do that as well, and try and sort of build between us a big UK community of self-sufficiency people that are trying to live a sort of lifestyle.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I think that just about covers it then. And just left to say thank you very much and speak to you soon.
If you find this podcast valuable, there's several ways you can support it. The easiest of which is to rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. You could also talk about it or share it wherever you post online, including your social media pages. And now you can support the podcast directly by becoming a patron at patreon.com/selfsufficienthub. However you support the podcast, we really appreciate it. Thank you for listening. See you soon.